Hello, everyone. I'm Dennis Sanders, the host of Church in Maine. This is episode 142. And in this episode, we'll talk about a crisis of faith in our churches. Hello and welcome. This is episode 142 of Church in Maine. This is the podcast that is at the intersection of faith and modern life. My name is Dennis Sanders. I am a pastor here in Minneapolis and St. Paul in Minnesota. And I am your host of this podcast. So, as I said, I'm a pastor and a pastor of a mainline Protestant denomination congregation. My congregation is a part of the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, and I'm also ordained in that denomination. Like a lot of mainline Protestant denominations, it is in decline. And like a lot of mainline Protestant congregations, the congregation that I serve is also dealing with decline. These are churches that may have at one time been had lots of people and don't have as many people now. And like a lot of people and a lot of organizations and congregations, especially after COVID, we're kind of trying to figure out what to do next. And like a lot of people, for years, I would read lots of different books about renewal and revival and what we need to do and what things that you can do. And here are these tips. And I've gone to conferences. And I think that there are some good things that come from those things. So I don't want to knock all of them. But it was interesting. Last summer, I decided to read a book that I felt really was answering kind of something that was going on, really already going on in my soul for a while, that wondered, what if we didn't try to do the newest and flashiest thing as a congregation, but we simply met for worship and came together for prayer and studied the Bible? And I didn't really have a way of trying to put that into words or to try to really flesh out what that all meant. But that was something I was kind of dealing with. And then this last summer, I decided to start reading Church in the Crisis of Decline by Dr. Andrew Root. And it was kind of, in some ways, mind-blowing, because I felt like this was actually kind of getting at what I was thinking for all of these years, but not really voicing, and realizing this was kind of maybe what I was thinking, I've been thinking about, and even also adding some things that I hadn't even thought about. And maybe the courage to not feel that we have to do the latest and greatest thing at the congregation, but maybe to sit still, to slow down, and to see and be attentive to God's presence, which sometimes in our busyness with trying to deal with declining churches, I really think sometimes we forget that, you know, this is kind of about God, and we don't always pay attention to that. So today, for this episode, I am interviewing Andy Root, and I have been very excited. I've been looking forward to being able to talk to him, especially after reading this book. I'm starting to read his latest book, The Church After Innovation. And so I really enjoy this. I really enjoyed the book. I'm looking for, and I think you will enjoy this interview. I really had a great time talking to him. In this interview, we will talk about churches in decline, about kind of how really, in some ways, revival can really only come, as I said earlier, when we kind of slow down, when we're able to stop, and we're able to really be open to seeing where God is active, to see and sense God's presence. And maybe I hope that if anything, you will come away from this, maybe wondering that maybe the crisis that we've been dealing with is not decline, but maybe one of faith in the God, in God, or as Andy likes to say, the God who is God. So a little bit about Andy Root. He is the Kerry Olson Balson Professor of Youth and Family Ministry at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, which happens to be my alma mater. He teaches on youth and family ministry, but he has also written extensively on issues surrounding kind of the cross-section of faith and our secular age, which is kind of right in line with this podcast. So he lives in St. Paul with his wife, Cara, who is a Presbyterian minister, and they have two kids. If the last name sounds familiar, it's because actually in the fall I did interview Cara, and we talked about her congregation, which is in South Minneapolis, and about their decision to kind of go practice Sabbath. She is an author in her own right. I will put a link to that episode in the show notes. And so once you're done listening to this episode, give that episode a listen. But without further ado, let's go into this fascinating discussion that I had with Professor Andrew Root. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I think the first thing I wanted to kind of start off with is finding out a little bit of background about yourself. This is probably the first time in the podcast that I've actually had a husband and wife on. I had your wife, Cara, on back in, I think, September, October. I've known actually Cara for 15, yeah, 16 years through our work in the presbytery. So I haven't known much about you as much as except for reading in books, but would love to hear a little bit about your background. Especially, I know a little bit, have heard a little bit about your childhood and how that may have connected to your work today.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm honored to be the husband and wife team on the podcast. So people can rank which one was better. I'm sure hers will be far more interesting. She's a far more interesting person than I am, but we can compete here on that. So I grew up in the Twin Cities. I grew up in a suburb of St. Paul called Woodbury, which right now is like the Uber suburb of the eastern suburbs, as you well know. And when I grew up there, though, it was just a little farm town, really. You know, so it was all these East Side St. Paul folks who got a little money, and like my parents, and moved to the suburbs. So that's where I grew up, and you know, we used to go to baseball tournaments and things like that, and people would be like, "Where's Woodbury?" And now, if you know anything about the Twin Cities, you know it's this Uber suburb. And so I grew up there, and I grew up in a Lutheran church. I am now teaching in an ELCA seminary. I've been teaching there for 17 years, but I grew up in a conservative Lutheran denomination, the Missouri Synod, and that formed me in a certain way. And kind of early Reformation theology has it stuck. Like confirmation, actually, I'm one of those people where confirmation really worked on me. And but became involved. One of the beautiful things about that church was it got me really involved in ministry at a young age, you know, doing VBS and just really involved in my youth ministry, but felt a kind of call to ministry when I was in high school. and didn't know what that would mean. Never thought it would mean being an academic in any way. You know, any of my high school friends would think, my gosh, that would be the last thing this guy would do. You know, like, I was more of a prankster, you know, like wannabe jock guy, not a bookworm in any stretch of the imagination. But then, you know, you go to college and stuff happens. So, yeah, it was kind of, you know, the Missouri Synod is interesting because it's kind of, I guess, politically, sociologically, an evangelical denomination, at least when it kind of comes to those sociological markers, but didn't function liturgically that way. It functioned very Lutheran kind of liturgically. Mm-hmm. And so didn't really know where to go to college. And so ended up at a Baptist college here in the Twin Cities, Bethel College at the time, Bethel University is what it's called now. And became really clear that I wasn't Baptist. I love Baptists and appreciated that education, but it led me back to my early Reformation roots in many ways. And then ended up in seminary in Southern California, mainly because it seemed, well, it had a great reputation, but also Fuller Seminary did, but also, you know, there was no snow to shovel in February. That seemed like an amazing deal to get out of the cold Twin Cities. And, but even there, like, started reading Bonhoeffer and really found, heard a calling. I mean, still to stay in ministry, but really to start to wrestle with big ideas. And so, you know, one thing led to another, as they say, and went from an MDiv program to a Master's of Theology program, a THM program to a PhD program. And, you know, now I've been teaching at a seminary for 18 years. And, writing books, which, again, you would have told my 16-year-old self that I write books, and I would have thought, you don't even know how to spell words. How could you do that? So, you know, it's a surprise of God to be doing this. But yeah, that's me.
So how important was it for you? It kind of sounds like for you that the Missouri Synod was helpful in helping you to be who you are. And I think one thing I noticed, because I'm someone that came from an evangelical background and now in the mainline, and especially for me, growing up gay, is that usually you kind of want to reject all of that. And I've tended not to, personally, just because I think that there are certain things that I think helped shape who I am. That, you know, yeah, there was a lot of bad stuff, but there was a lot of good stuff too. And I guess I'm seeing that was also similar for you, that you found things that were good, to come from your Missouri Synod background.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm with you, Dennis, completely that, I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't know how to say this in some sense. Like, I don't want to undervalue other people's experience. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that, you know, it's become a major kind of internet thing to kind of become X, whatever kind of conservative background you were. And I think that for some people that comes out of real pain and in real, you know, experiences of rupture and hardship. So I would never want to belittle that anyway. But for me, I've always felt like it was necessary in my own, I guess in my own kind of Christian life and the integrity of my Christian life to find a way to embrace my past and to recognize that, yeah, there was a lot of goofy theological things, you know, things that now that I would find very troubling, like not ordaining women or what have you. But there are also people there who, because of the gospel, really loved me and invested in my life and taught me that the ways I think about God matter. And ultimately at the core, which I've really kept with me and has probably been really the central dynamic of even my academic life, is the commitment that God moves in history, that God does things, that God, that God is an actor in the world, that God's not just a religious idea. And even the church isn't just a kind of religious collective, but it is a place where we confess that God moves in the world and that God does work in the world that is saving work. And, you know, that was weird sometimes, you know, like as that worked itself out, but I've never lost that. And so I always want to be deeply appreciative of that past, whether it was in the Missouri Synod or whether it even was in kind of, you know, classic high evangelicalism at Bethel College, you know, and, you know, by high evangelicalism, I mean no liturgy at all, just five praise songs and a 45-minute sermon. That wasn't a sermon. It was, you know, a teaching. Mm-hmm. Even in those experiences, like, I don't want to undersell those, or I don't want to belittle them because I'm embarrassed by them. I want to recognize that they were gifts from God. And, you know, you've spent now almost 20 years, more than 20 years in the main line. And there's some wacky, crazy things about the main line too, you know? So, very different, you know, almost, you know, the very, exact different, but we all have our goofy things that we're living with. And so, I want to be thankful for those experiences.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, talking about the sense of God acting, especially in history and in the world, and that's something that has been or can be missing in mainline circles?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think in an odd way, it's in some ways missing in both evangelical and mainline, but it gets vocalized in very different ways. Because another element of my kind of conservative past, especially going from a classically kind of Lutheran background to an evangelical one, to a kind of Baptist evangelical one, is towards the end of my college years, it felt like we talked about God doing things all the time, but there was really no process of discernment. And I didn't know when it was God and when it was my own subjective experience. And so it really became that in its own sense, there's a certain way that talking about God all the time doing stuff was another way of God not doing anything, if that makes any sense. You know, like it becomes so much built around what I want it to be or how I interpret it, that there's really no sense of the otherness of God that might be judging me or kind of moving me in a certain direction over and against even what I kind of subjectively feel or how I might interpret this. And yet in the mainline, I think we're really quite afraid of this very almost consumeristic sense of God acting. We don't want God to be a product. We don't want God to become just a mascot or something, but that almost leads us to not have that imagination at all. Like, you know, to over intellectualize things and be like, well, smart people don't talk like that. Even though we have 2000 years of different Christian traditions and plenty of Christian traditions outside the West that talk quite often about, you know, God speaking and God moving. And so I think as kind of American Protestantism has really struggled with how do we talk about the revelation of God? How do we talk about God moving? And in really diametrically different ways, both evangelicalism and the mainline have struggled with that in the last 50 years.
Hmm. So one of the things and the reason I why I joined the podcast was primarily for a book of Church in the Crisis of Decline. And decline is something, especially within mainline churches, I think that's probably starting to happen even within evangelical circles, of the sense of decline happening in churches. And the interesting thing is how churches have responded to that. And I think a lot of the thesis of your book is this sense of feeling like we have to have all of these resources, the things that we have to do to try to make sure that the church is still relevant in our day and age. And how can or have churches in some ways, I guess, gone off of the beaten track when it comes to decline? How have they responded and probably basically how have they not responded faithfully in this sense of decline?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there is a sense with the title of the book, you know, Churches in the Crisis of Decline. It was funny when that book was when they announced the title of the book and it showed up on Amazon and things that have people write me and say, oh, I'm so glad you see your book's coming out. This is the real issue. Decline is, you know, we got to face this or the church is going to disappear in a generation. It was like, oh, I don't think you really know what's in this book. So there's something a little misleading about the title, I think, that is it has a little clickbait element to it, you know, churches in the crisis of decline, because I ultimately think that the crisis of decline or you know, decline, I think crisis is true. I think we're in a crisis, but I think the crisis of decline is the red herring. And I think that it, we feel it. And I, and that's not to, to undersell any pastor, you know, listening. Like, you, I know Cara is more than aware that one roof leak and you're toast, you know, like, that's all it's going to take is, you know, some water problem in the basement, you know, and it could sink you, you know, so there is a real sense of the fragility of that. And I don't want to undersell that, nor do I want to flippantly say like, well, who cares about buildings? Because these have been people for generations who out of faithfulness gave to keep these buildings going. And there is something to hold on to there. But I do think what keeps most pastors up at night is this kind of sense that there are fewer people, and fewer people means fewer resources. And so we need more people so we have more resources, or maybe we need more resources so we can get more people. Like, there becomes this kind of caught in a kind of trap of, is it more resources or more people? But if we had more resources, more people, we'd eventually have more relevance. And that's really what would then give us more resources and more people. You know, there becomes this kind of never ending, almost consumer cycle that we need this. And I do think to be a Protestant means that there's a crisis. Like, you live always in a sense of crisis. But I think what's happened to us in the late 20th century into the 21st century is we've turned the crisis almost completely into a crisis of resources and members. And most pastors have that experience of kind of not being able to sleep at night. Like, you know, you wake up and all of a sudden the fear hits you. And usually what that is like, roof is leaking, or why have I been at this for 6 years and we have fewer members than when I started with, you know, I must be awful at my job. I think that's usually what keeps people up at night. And yet I think historically, and even more captivating, the crisis, and I think really culturally at this moment, the real crisis is that we proclaim a God who speaks and moves in history, and yet we are formed culturally to not be aware of that. And so what I wish kept pastors up at night was, how am I going to help these people who are over busy, who are dealing with all sorts of, you know, mental health struggles or just dealing with the stresses of life? How am I going to help them hear the word of God again? I think that's a crisis. I think that inside of this kind of secular age we live in, it's not a secular age that lacks spirituality, but it is a secular age that lacks a kind of sense of the continued presence of a living God. You know, that this is a kind of secular age where people can say things like, I'm taking a break from God for a while, or a pastor could even say, I haven't thought about God in 3 weeks. You know, like, you just couldn't say that 500 years ago, like the way our societies were structured. You couldn't say that other parts of the globe right now, that, you know, you couldn't say that you could just not think about God, but we can. That's the kind of secular age we live in. And I think that's the crisis we face, is how do we help those in our congregations again hear the voice of the living God, to see the movements of God. And I don't think there's many pastors who, you know, stare at that ceiling in the middle of the night, unable to sleep because they're worried about that. But I think maybe we should. Like, that's really our concern, is how do we help people have that imagination again for that?
Why do you think that is, that there are people that will stay up late at night and we're worried about, basically, to be frank, butts and pews, but we're not interested in helping people to really have a strong relationship with God?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a few reasons. The one I really try to explore in the book is, you know, again, probably to my fault, I've been addicted to really wrestling with the Catholic Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor's work. And one of the things that he says that I really try to take on in this book, and it's a 700-page project that he's after, so I found that it's taken me, you know, 6 books to be able to articulate its ramifications for, maybe I'm just crazy and nuts, but it's, you know, taken me 6 books to try to get at the depth of what this means for us for ministry. But what becomes really central in this one is that the way our institutions function and the way it just is to live in late modernity is we're given this kind of imminent frame where we just presume things are more natural and material than, say, spiritual or supernatural. Now, you can find all sorts of folks, you know, in storefront churches in every city in this country who believe something very different and have experiences that are very different. And in many ways, Pentecostalism is a kind of pushback to the reductions of that imminent frame. But it still is a kind of modern response to the presumption that things are natural and material, that that transcendence is not a real engagement in our lives. And I think that's part of the issue, is that we tend to live inside of this imminent frame and do ministry inside this imminent frame. So even sometimes over and against our best intentions, like we would like to speak of a living God, we'd like our people to encounter the presence of God and Bible study or whatever practices, that it becomes so hard to break that imminent frame. And in many ways, we're kind of encouraged to keep the imminent frame closed, you know, to close it down. And even, I think one of the places Taylor says where you can find a closed imminent frame, like there's no way out of the imminent frame, but it could be open, and there could be open experiences in it. But we also find places where it's quite closed. And he says one of the places where it's closed is usually in universities, that there's more of a presumption there than almost anywhere else in our culture that we are dealing with only natural material things. And I think a lot of us mainliners, or even us evangelicals who've been drawn to the mainline, have been drawn to more of the intellectual capacities of that. And so we really struggle with, can we be smart people and have this imminent frame be open? Can we kind of have an intellectual Christianity and still make the claim that the God of the Bible moves even in our day and age? And so I think that becomes a big piece of it. And then the other one is it just the rebounding on us of resources and the senses of decline. It just, who's got time? You know, like in many ways, what we feel the crisis is will take our attention, you know, regardless. And that's, you know, for just good evolutionary reasons. Like if there's some animal gnawing off your leg, you should probably pay attention to that, you know. But you could be confused on what that actually is going on. But we feel like this existential threat is the loss of this. And that is part of the imminent frame in its own right, that we are kind of framed by market, a certain market imagination, you know. So whether we want to be kind of against certain forms of capitalism or not, it's amazing even how, you know, mainline folks who want to push back against neoliberal capitalism end up being very much formed by it. And so the best churches become the ones who are growing and the ones who have are winning people. And so it's hard for us to have different evaluative measures of what it would even mean to be faithful. You know, I think in most presbyteries and synods and others, like to stand up in front of your colleagues and be like, yeah, our church has 10 people in it. And, you know, we had 13 last year, we had 10 this year, but God is moving and God is faithful. A lot of people would be really quite embarrassed by that, you know, but at other times that it really didn't matter how many people, it mattered the faithfulness to these people. And gosh, you know, the way God was calling you into this and you could testify to it. But now I think we almost always assume that, like you said, more butts in pews means you're more successful. So even the way we think about ourselves, I think, leads us to close ourselves into the imminent frame.
So, you know, I think one of the things that I found interesting in the book and in talking about this, and I think the phrase that I heard a lot in that book was about waiting for God, and how all of this in some ways seems counterintuitive to what we've grown up in, that everything has to be about activity, that we have to do things, we have to do all, and especially if we're in decline, we have all these things we need to do. And, you know, kind of this, how the book is reading is basically saying, no, it's about waiting. And that's, I think, is hard for our culture, because I feel like we feel like we have to do stuff. We need to do stuff. And if we don't do stuff, then it's all over.
Yeah, we actually should feel great amounts of shame if we don't do stuff. You know, how dare you? Especially if you're in a crisis, and the crisis is somewhat your your own, even if it's not completely yours, it's someone's fault that they didn't do the right thing. Then, gosh, to do nothing, how awful could that be? You know, so yeah, you know, there is a, you know, to echo the line from the classic film Shawshank Redemption, you know, like where Andy tells Red, you either get busy living or you get busy dying. But one of the kind of cultural realities with us is you get busy. Whatever you do, just be busy. And even if you get busy dying, just get busy. And I do think like that the depth, at least of the mystical traditions in Christianity, is something different. And I suppose we should be very frightened of waiting. If the point of human life, the good life, is about getting what you want, so you're the only one who's going to win that. You should stay away from that. You should make sure that you're not waiting. But also, you know, if there isn't a God who is responsible for this, and if there isn't a God that at the core of what it means to be a pastor, what a core it means to be a congregation, is to commune with this living God, if we don't either tacitly or directly believe that, then yeah, you better go and go and go and go and go, because you are in a shrinking religious marketplace. And if you don't act, you know, you're going to go to zero, and then you should feel, you know, deep levels of shame. But if God is God, and then there's no way for us to control this God. And all we can do, and I think this is reflected in the biblical text, is wait on this God to act, to wait on this God to move. And there is something really countercultural and faithful about a church who could wait for God. Mm-hmm. And I know it almost feels repulsive. It feels somewhat disobedient in some ways. But really, I think what it's disobedient is, again, to those kind of capitalist forms, more than it's disobedient to how the people of Israel waited on God and waited on God. I mean, my gosh, Abraham just waits and waits on God. And when he tries to take his own action, things get really messed up in a really bad way. It doesn't go well at all. And in many ways, it goes badly to teach Israel that God will self-actualize what needs to do. The word of God does not need Abraham. What the word of God needs is Abraham's impossibility. That's when God will move, you know. So there is just something, I think, at the core of the Judeo-Christian spirituality, that we become waiting people, you know, mm-hmm. like in the church calendar is a sense of waiting for the season of Advent. And yet, as, you know, these kind of secular people that we are inside of an imminent frame, we hate waiting. Like, we think waiting is, we're just bathed in a consumer society where the whole point is to take all waiting out of wanting. If you want it, you should get it now. And I think there's a certain way of pushing back by saying, no, what we do as a church is we wait on God. And I guess it goes back to even to my own story of discernment. Like, if we're really going to discern, if we first of all believe God is living and active, then we have to discern this. You know, mm-hmm. we have to really think, is this God, or is this the fact that's, you know, the person who's saying this had NyQuil and wine together, you know, and now they're really, no, this is not. We need to discern this. And that means we have to wait and be patient and, you know, be able to tell stories and read scripture together and ultimately keep reminding ourselves that we don't control God, that mm-hmm. God is not our mascot. That God moves as God moves. And I think it's really important that we learn how to be a kind of waiting church.
And what does that mean, especially in a culture where the self and is so central? And, you know, you see this especially in social media. And I'm not someone because I'm of my background, I don't blame social media for everything, but I also know it's present there. And it's also present in kind of in churches. And I think something that you've talked about in the book is that the churches have to stop considering themselves at the center of the story. Yeah. And again, how that seems like that's something that is at both, you know, of course that makes sense. But I think also because of the cultural forces and everything, it does also seem like that's harder than it looks to not be the center of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're really right. Like we live in a whole kind of cultural realm where the self we have, that we're pretty obsessed with ourselves. And I think across the board, because of these digital tools we have and just because of the way other structures work. But the kind of self we're really obsessed with is a performative one, you know, how we perform ourselves. And I think that happens with the church too. I mean, the church is being led by people who feel deeply tempted to be performative selves. And then we feel like the church has to perform, you know? And usually the most clear way of how the church is performing is how many resources and how many people, you know? So, like, that's the first question most pastors ask each other is, you know, how many people are in your church? Which is a performative question. So, yeah, it does, man, it does move us into a kind of different stance than performance. And yeah, there's just a deep way that it really moves us into a stance of having to receive a gift, which I do again think is at the core of the Christian story, is that the kind of disposition the human being has in response to God's grace and God's action is to, in some sense, be passive, to receive the gifts of God. But it does mean that I have to confess my own kind of unmagnificence or my own need, you know? And if I'm unwilling to confess my need, that I need God, that I need to be in a community, that I need forgiveness, that I need to forgive others, then yeah, there becomes the only purpose for any kind of faith commitment, and maybe even religion in general, is how it helps me deal with myself, you know, how I can use religion to optimize my own creative self in the world. And maybe religion can be a way I can perform myself, or at least the tool I can use as I go in this battle for recognition for myself, you know, where I think at the core, and this is hard for us in this time, but at the core of the Christian story is that we need something from outside of us to save us, that what it's not all within us, you know, that we are made in God's image. We are beautiful. We are wonderfully made, but we are made to be in communion with God. And therefore we need something from outside of us to save us. And I think the performative dynamics are very much that if you can just find your truest self and you can just win recognition, then you can save yourself. You know, you can, your star can shine. And I do think that connects to, you know, like you were saying, to congregational life, where because we feel like we're performing to survive, you know, like we are dancing for our dinner in some sense, that, you know, all sorts of consultants and others tell pastors all the time, like if you're, you know, there's eight churches in your community and yours is declining, you better figure out what your story is. You know, you got to figure out your story, why you're different. And I get that as an institutional level, but it also is a theological problem that the church has no story, that the story in the star of the story, I should say the church has a story, but it is not the star of the story. The star of the church's story is God. And even the, you know, best supporting actor nomination doesn't go to the church. The church is not, the church doesn't even serve that role. The story, the two protagonists in the story are God, the world that God is saving. And the church's job is to narrate that, to point to that, to participate in that, to recognize that it is part of the world and that it waits with the world and reminds the world to wait for God to come. But we often tell pastors and others that you better find your story, what makes you different. Because if you don't, you're going to lose. And yet I think that they're at the core of this, that the church, when it gets caught up in its own story, becomes incredibly narcissistic. And really, there is this need to come out of ourselves and to remind ourselves that there's a beautiful place for us in God's story, but God is the star of the story.
Yeah, I think one of the things because I lead a congregation that I would say is in decline, and you hear a lot from people that you have to find something that makes you unique or find your ministry. And there's always a part of me that wants to push back against that because and I say this as someone, I'm not, you know, against capitalism or anything, but it feels like, okay, but that feels like we're trying to find market share or something. And that's great if we were Target or Walmart, but that's not who we are, that we're the church. And I don't think that we need to necessarily compete for something. I mean, it's that's not who we are. And it seems like that I've also noticed a lot of churches that try to do that. And in some ways, it doesn't work. That there are still problems, that it doesn't solve all of their problems.
Right. And I think in many ways it makes more of them, you know, like I think one of the fascinating things especially this kind of European French social theory that's been out is there's been a couple thinkers who've thought a great deal about kind of how depression kind of functions. And they've tied some forms of despondency to this kind of this performative self in that they think in a larger cultural realm that depression isn't so much a pathology, is one of the quotes, the pathology of unhappiness. It's actually a pathology of change. Mm-hmm. And that there's this demand to continue to perform the self and change and find more creativity and go and go and go. And when you run out of energy for that, wow, you just feel burnt out. You're just burnt out. And so it creates all these conditions of burnout. So there's been these really interesting thinkers who have named that. And so one of the titles of the book is The Weariness of the Self, is by a Parisian thinker named Alan Ehrenberg, which doesn't sound very Parisian to me, but you know, I suppose if he has a baguette in his hand, then it would all, you know, maybe it would be better. But it's better, and it's French translation is more insightful. The French translation is the La Fatigue d'être soi, which is the fatigue of being yourself, is his title, which seems really insightful to me. Hmm. Like, you know, that this need to perform all the time leads people to become fatigued with trying to be this unique self, the fatigue of being yourself. And I wonder if part of the problem with mainline Christianity, and I think evangelicalism too, is if we don't have the La Fatigue d'être l'Église, where we become almost too tired to be church. And this becomes, you know, the side effect of this is that you start playing this game of needing to do more, of needing, you know, to beat back decline, and all of a sudden you become too tired to be really what you are, which is this unique community of persons who have all sorts of stories of seeking for God in darkness and loss and finding each other through these moments. All of a sudden those stories and those experiences don't matter, because we just got to get more people. We just got to become more interesting. We just got to go, go, go. We're losing, like you said, we're losing market share. Every week we're losing more market share, and we better go, go, go. And we lose the very beauty of what it means to be a church, which is the concrete personhood of one another, living with one another, living, I mean, quite literally. I mean, what other institution in the West has this institution that lives and dies together, that welcomes children and buries people and thinks about the whole trajectory of a human life that way? I mean, you know, like you said, Walmart and Target don't do that, you know. I mean, my gosh, if they could sell you a casket and they could mark it up, they would. But not like, how do you prepare for this? How this community that's going to walk through these moments with you? Like, this is it's a beautifully unique thing to have a group of people who will think about a whole life and walk through it. But I just, again, worry that all of a sudden that becomes pointless or secondary, because we're so afraid that we're, you know, we're losing all these resources and all this relevance.
What do you think is the importance of story when it comes to congregations and kind of the life of a congregation? And the reason I bring that up is that I think that was one of the central parts of the book. And you actually relate that to a fictional church, kind of giving them an alternate story. And what was fascinating in that alternate story were the stories within that alternate story. And so what is the importance of the story, but also our stories in the life of churches?
Well, I do go very Quentin Tarantino in it. And, you know, I don't know if that makes, there's not any F bombs, I don't think. So maybe, you know, it's not like Pulp Fiction Quentin Tarantino, but it is, you know, like the last, what, Quentin Tarantino's last four movies or something are kind of alternate histories, you know, so like imagining how history would have been different, like rewriting it. And like the last, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is like, what if the Sharon Tate murders didn't happen and they were stopped? Or, you know, what would have happened if all the Nazi hierarchy was bombed and killed in a Paris movie theater, you know, like playing with these alternate histories. So I try to play with this alternate history of a church that has closed, that I actually experienced in a microbrewery pub that used to be a church, and on the back of its menu was just like four lines of the congregation that used to, you know, be there. Like, you're now eating the best wings in Pittsburgh in this old church that, you know, was built in right after World War One. You know, like there's just like these four lines. And so I'm in the book, I'm trying to play this alternate history of like, what would have kept this church open? And again, you know, the theme of what we've been talking about, I just don't think it would have been more relevance, more creativity. There's something else at play. So I try to tell that story, and story, you know, to get to your question directly, like story is so significant because I think what we need more than anything is just to change our imagination, and stories are the way we change our imagination, that we see the world differently, that we think differently. And so I feel like even, you know, pastors reading this book, there's a lot of theory, there's a lot of ideas, there's too many footnotes within it, but ultimately the story is trying to kind of carry the water and help you think about this differently and think about your ministry differently and think about the significance of what you do in a different way. So it all plays in there, but at the core for me really is that how important narrative is for our transformation, that we need, that we are just narrative beings, you know, that we are, that our lives are constructed around stories. And we know this from its opposite. Like when someone goes through an identity crisis, usually it's because they've lost the stories that they've held, you know? Mm-hmm. So like if they're, you know, they thought they were in a strong relationship with their partner, and then they, you know, the independent movie version, they come home and they found a note that says, "I've been having an affair for, you know, for 5 years." And all of a sudden that person is in an identity crisis, and they didn't even do the moral violation, but they feel like they don't know who they are anymore because the story that they were living out of wasn't true, or they found it to kind of fall apart. So we always have our identities around stories, and we always make our way into feeling out the kind of shape of reality through stories. There's just no other way, I think, to be a human being than through stories. And even if we, you know, don't have the cognitive capacities, like towards the end of our lives, maybe to hold on to our stories because we're in dementia, we still are bound to others who hold our story. And, you know, live inside of their stories and have a place in their stories and actually are dependent on that, you know, that people remind us of our stories or at least continue to treat us as, you know, as friend or grandfather or whatever. So stories are really central. And I think for me, they even carry this theological weight of being, well, what becomes significant is the relationships we have with one another and how those relationships are really about sharing in each other's lives. And I, for me, that becomes really deeply sacramental. And this is what I kind of take from Bonhoeffer, is that when we share in each other's personhood, there's a way that we sacramentally share in the very life of Jesus Christ who is present. And to do that kind of depth of sharing in each other's lives, we need stories. And stories have this beautiful element of being both open and closed to us. And in other words, that, you know, I morally violate you if I steal your story and take it as mine. I don't allow you to have voice to tell your story. So there is a sense of it there being differentiation where I have to see you as other because you have your own story here. But at the same time, I can connect to your story and your story can change me. And I think even like for Paul, hearing a story can bring you into the life of Jesus Christ, you know, like for Paul's churches, not everyone has had the same experiences he's had with the very presence of the living Jesus Christ, but in hearing his story of it, they can commune with the Spirit too. So there's something really powerful in how stories bind us together while allowing us to kind of hold on to our distinct humanity, but then be bound to one another in the midst of it.
Mm. That kind of relates to a concept. And we've been talking really that churches, I think, strive a lot to be relevant. But you bring up another concept, and that's resonance. And what does that mean in the context of a church? And what does that mean actually? Well, I know it's kind of coming from the wider culture, but how does that relate to us in the church?
Yeah. So resonance is a concept that I'm borrowing from this German social theorist named Hartmut Rosa. And his first project was, his early work was really talking about how acceleration just comes everywhere. Our lives just keep speeding up and speeding up and speeding up and speeding up. And what that does to us, that it tends to make us feel alienated. And again, you know, to kind of show us the positive by looking at it against the backdrop of the negative, like part of the problem with it being about resources and butts and seats and relevance is that it demands that the pastor do more with less, go faster, mm-hmm. go. And what that can lead to is a sense of alienation. I would imagine there's a lot of pastors listening here who have moments of feeling deeply alienated from their own practice, feeling deeply alienated from themselves, to feel like the world and ministry itself becomes joyless because you become just kind of disconnected from it, becomes an object that you're trying to somehow master. And what became fascinating about Rosa is he thought, well, we need a different way of acting, and this all is about speeding up our lives. So what we need to do is slow down. We need to go slower. And I guess this is also the kind of to think about waiting, which we talked about a few minutes ago, is that there is a way of thinking of slowing down as a form of waiting, wait. But what he wants to get at is that won't be good enough. Like we have experiences of slowing down. We call those the weekend, or we call those vacation, or at the end of our work lives, we call those retirement. And yet you talk to most people and the weekend is, people come back from the weekend exhausted, and people come back from vacation and look at their inbox and are like, why did I go on vacation? Now I need to work, you know, three times harder just to get my inbox down after a week of being away. And so his point is that, yeah, we should all slow down. But we need something more than just slowing down. We need a different form of engaging the world, a different mm-hmm. form of action within the world. And he thinks we do have experiences of that. And those are experiences of resonance. They tend to get buried by all this do more with less, go faster, go faster, go faster. But there are these experiences where we feel like the world speaks to us, where we feel alive again, we feel a connection to something, where we feel the gift of receiving someone's presence, or we see a piece of art and it speaks to us. And we become in time in a different way when that happens. You know, you don't feel rushed in time. You can feel exhausted from the experience, but you feel like you were in time, like you were in the midst of it. Yet you're not even sure how long was that movie? It felt, you know, my gosh, looking at my watch, it was 3 hours. It felt like it was 20 minutes because you're so deeply taken into the story again. And he thinks that these are experiences of resonance, that we have these resonant encounters where it doesn't feel like we have to accelerate, but that we're met and that we're encountered in a deep way. So I tried to play with that. And that does go back to the waiting too. If waiting is just a slowing down, it will be just like being in a, you know, in a gate where your flight is delayed by an hour and you're just like, give me it. You know, you hate it. And you're just like, I just want to get going. But a waiting that is a waiting with people in storytelling and in community and in prayer, a waiting that is seeking to lean into where God is moving in the world becomes a waiting of resonance, a waiting of being connected to one another. And often that connection is not, and Rose is really clear on this, is that it isn't always positive. You know, sometimes we feel the most deeply connected in moments of suffering and loss. And a lot of pastors will say, mm-hmm. like, where they feel the most connected is when they do a funeral. And usually mm-hmm. it's because in those moments of suffering and taking people through those experiences of grief, they feel a deep sense of connection. It's not about optimization. It's not about taking this experience and instrumentalizing it for something more. It's about really attending to these people and attending to their stories and being with them. And it's just no shock that for most pastors, they feel like that's where I feel most alive. That's where I feel like I'm doing my best ministry is in funerals, because these become moments that demand a sense of resonance and not just a sense of like, okay, can you get 8 members out of this funeral? Can you make sure that you know, we need to gross $8,000 to $10,000 out of this funeral? Like that would be crass. That would be a problem. And yet so much more. Almost all other parts of ministry have those demands, you know. So that's what he means by resonance.
Hmm. And have you seen examples of that happening in churches where people are actually kind of slowing down, taking that time? to really listen for God, listen to each other?
Yeah, and usually I have. And sometimes it just, my gosh, it just happens. You can't control it. I mean, this becomes one of the elements he wants to talk about residence, is if you try to control it, then you instrumentalize it. And you can't control it. He says you can set kind of conditions, semi-controlled experiences. And I would say in some ways, like a worship is a semi-controlled experience. And this goes back to the sense of God being God too. You can't say, you know, I know if we sing these hymns, if we preach this sermon, God will show up. No. Not if God is God. God is free to show up or not show up. There's no formula. There's no magical incantation that brings the God of Israel to show up. You have to wait for this God, but this God gives us practices we can take to be aware, to be prepared for that. So we can't control it, but we can set conditions for it. And I think setting conditions for it is really attending to our relationships. So there are times I've seen it in churches where all of a sudden someone just says something, or you've been going through something with someone. And I think, you know, like Kara articulates this in her book so well about the experience with Marty, you know, like all of a sudden Marty just shows up and confesses he has cancer and how this community needs to gather around him. And there becomes many experiences of resonance in the midst of that. But I think we can, storytelling becomes a big one for us to do that. But I've also had an experience doing a grant, which in a more formal way, which is this experience called Peel, which is inviting people to get in groups. You do it with 12 people over 3 days, which is its big challenge, which has also been a huge learning, is that almost no one feels like they can give up 3 days. And you wonder, my gosh, how do we be church if we can't be together? And in be together, not for any other purpose than to be together. And in this process, you get teamed up with somebody and you go through a process of taking a picture of them, like taking a portrait of them, and then writing a poem about them. And there's really no other objective than to really see this person, to really hear this person, and then to give a word act and in a poem that's supposed to reflect in some way beauty as best as you can who this person is. And people come in and are like, I don't know how to take a picture and I've never written a poem in my life. And yet over these 3 days, they really see this other person and end up taking a beautiful picture of them and writing an incredible poem with them. And that encounter becomes transformational. But it takes 3 days and people feel like, well, I don't have 3 days for that. I mean, if you're going to tell me in those 3 days, we can make sure your church has a 10% growth, well, I could give 3 days for that. But to give 3 days just to get to know to someone and just to be with them and just to do something artistic that might speak to me, well, that seems like a waste of time. And to me, that's a huge piece of the tragedy that we're confronting, is that it is enough to just be together and just to wait on our confessions of our need for God and to rally around those and to try to discern how God is leading us. That really is enough. And yet we feel like, well, it would be a waste of 3 days to just really get to know someone and take a picture of them and have an experience with 12 other people of doing this. What's the objective? What do we get out of this? How do we turn this into something that's sustainable and optimizable? And yet I think once you put your hands on it that way, you kind of strangle the beauty of it.
It sounds like in talking about this, that there's a lot of seeing church. Well, I think part of our culture is that we see church as a business, and we probably see it that way, whether we acknowledge it or not, or even if we say it isn't. But that it may need to see things more in the way of art. And to appreciate things and not always feel like you have to understand it all or to have something that's measured, a measurable conclusion to everything, which again seems counterintuitive in our culture.
Yep. I think you're really right. There is a kind of artistic disposition to this, a way of being that is looking for the, I mean, we're, especially as American Protestants, you know, and back to the beginning of this podcast, talking about our mutual histories, it was all mm-hmm. about truth. What's the truth? What's the truth? Mm-hmm. And that is part of Christianity. That's part of the yeah. Christian confession, that truth matters. But so does beauty. And, yeah. you know, the Eastern Church has done a much better job of reminding us that truth and beauty are always interconnected. And I think our Protestant legacy, especially as North Americans, has been to be more about truth than beauty. And I think that we would do better by trying to keep those things together a little bit here.
Mm. Well, as we kind of wrap things up, I wanted to ask is, what advice would you give to pastors who are out there and even members of congregations that are kind of dealing with a lot of the things that churches are dealing with, especially post-COVID, loss of membership and sometimes loss of direction? What advice or maybe more better to say is, what word of hope would you give them
yeah.
in this time of what seems to be an uncertain time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the first thing I would want to say is I would want to affirm that these are uncertain times, and these are very difficult times. Last summer, Carr and I took our kids and we walked the St. Cuthbert's Way Southern Scotland in Northern England. Mm. And this pilgrimage ends at the Holy Island of Lindisfarne. And so you walk across, you have to wait till the tide goes out, and then you walk across the mud flats and finish this. We walked 63 miles with our high school kids.
Wow.
It was quite an experience. But when you get there, and we had the privilege of staying on the island for the night. There's a little church. I mean, there's ruins of an abbey, but then there's a little church that is still functions for the fishing community there and is still an operating Anglican church. But that church has been there since 635, since the cultic monk Aidan put stones, 635. And one of the most fascinating things is that there's a picture in the back, and it lists every abbot, bishop, or vicar who has been the pastor from Aidan in 635 all the way until they got their last vicar in 2018, who is Sarah Hillis, who is still the pastor there or something. That may not be her last name exactly, but something like that. And so you think of that, and that's amazing. 635 to 2018, you know, to right now have had that. There's been somebody worshiping in that space. But you look at it closely, and you notice from about 700 to 1000 for about 300 years, there was no one. There's 300 years where no one was worshiping in that church. And the reason no one was worshiping in it is because Viking raiders came and sacked that abbey, and they had to take their saints' bones and leave for 300 years. Mm. So my word of hope is that this is not a good time to be in the church. These are difficult times, but there aren't Viking raiders. In other words, the church has had more difficult times than this. You know, like these are not easy times. These are definitely not easy times. And when we look back historically, the first three decades of the 21st century, maybe the first five decades of the 21st century, maybe the whole of the 21st century will not have been the golden era of Christianity. But God is faithful. And the church has seen much bleaker times. And because of our narrative and our theology, when the church goes bankrupt, Christianity is reborn. And so we don't have to save the church. The church is God's responsibility, and we don't have to save Christianity. Now, we might lose things. We might lose denominational Christianity. We may lose, you know, God forbid, some of our seminaries. That there's no guarantee of that. But God is faithful, and the gospel is sure, true, and beautiful, and we will be okay. So we can take a breath. We can take a breath in the midst of this and know that God is faithful to see us through.
Hmm. Well, if people want to know more, to read any of your books or contact you online, how can they do that?
Yeah, so I have a website. That's probably the easiest place to go, which is just andrewroot.org. Don't ask me why it's a .org, but it is. but you can contact me through there, or you'll find there's a little way to contact me, or you can always Google me and find me on the Luther Seminary webpage, and you can find me on that dumpster fire of Twitter. I'm on that too. So I'm not very good at it, and I rarely tweet, but you could always send me a tweet as well.
All right. Well, Andy Root, thank you for taking the time and thank you for your words of hope, especially to a church as we're trying to kind of figure out how to be church in this day and age.
Thanks, Dennis. It's great to talk with you.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that interview. I really enjoyed it, recording it. And I hope that it was of help to you. I think one of the things that I take away from that, and it's actually something that I've been learning myself over the last year or two, is about the importance of what does kind of revival, what does a turnaround in a church look like? And I think we always like to look at that numerically. And that's not to say that we shouldn't. I would love my congregation to see more people because it's a small congregation. But I also think sometimes we tend to only look at the numbers and not really kind of the quality. How are people actually connecting with God? How are they being faithful with the resources that they have? How are they being faithful in the community that they live in? How are they seeing and finding ways of connecting and finding ways to see where God is active in our world? And to see that maybe with a second sight that we don't always see. There are a lot of different ways, I think, to be in some ways a church that is alive. And it doesn't always mean that you're going to be a church of 100 or 300 members. Sometimes you can be a live church with 20 members. And you can be in a church that has kind of lost its focus that has 500 members. And I think that that's important for anyone that's leading a congregation is what matters is how are we connecting with, as Andy Root has said, the God who is God. Because I think that's what matters. If we don't have that, then it's kind of hard. I won't say that we don't have a church, but we may be forgetting why we're there and who we are and for who we are there for. So again, I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Do consider liking or leaving a review on whatever podcast app that you listen to. That helps more people find this podcast. You can follow along on our Facebook page, also on Twitter, though these days I don't know how long we will continue on Twitter. I also would encourage you, if you follow along on Substack, to subscribe to our Substack page. That is at churchandmain, all one word, .substack.com. You can also go to our website, which is churchandmain, all one word, .org. And consider subscribing and getting on our mailing list. So that is it for this episode. This is episode 142 of Church in Maine. This is a podcast that is at the intersection of faith and modern life. I'm Dennis Sanders. I've been your host. Take care. Godspeed. And I will see you again very soon.